claims that law must be colorblind, or that the datum of race is no longer relevant to public policy, must be seen as aspiration rather than as descriptive of reality.
It has been 25 years since Justice Powell first suggested approval of the use of race to further an interest in student body diversity in the context of higher education. We expect that 25 years from now, the use of racial preferences will no longer be necessary to further the interest that we approve today.
Hello and welcome back to the High School SCOTUS podcast. It's been a while. My name is Elise Spenner.
My name is Hannah Soroff.
And we're bringing you our first episode, probably of many, breaking down the affirmative action ruling that the court released at the end of the term and all of its implications for students that attend college, that are applying to college, and that are just interested in this momentous and contentious decision. Our first guest to break down this decision is someone that was previously on the podcast when we were previewing Students for Fair Admissions versus Harvard and versus UNC, Lisa Solberg. Lisa is an associate professor of sociology of education at NYU Steinhardt School of Culture, Education, and Human Development. Her research focuses on the politics of race and education, affirmative action in higher education, school choice policy, and LGBTQ+ social change. She's the author and co-editor of tons of books, and she's the co-author of an upcoming book about the origins of affirmative action and race-conscious admissions, very relevant to today's conversation and the conversation that we have been having for the past few months on the podcast.
We basically just attacked her with questions, so it's going to be a long episode, so we're just going to get into it. Thank you so much, Lisa, and here's the interview.
Thank you so much for coming back and being here with us again.
Thanks for having me.
So we always ask our guests, as you know, what they were like in high school. And we already know that you were a nerd, as you told us. And that is what most of our guests are. So don't feel guilty. But we talked about how you attended college at Harvard, who were involved in the recent affirmative action case. And I feel like we didn't talk enough about that. What was Harvard like when you were there? How diverse was it? And was there an ongoing conversation about diversity at the time?
Yes, great question. So I was there a million years ago. I started in 1988 and graduated in 1992. And I was really politically active. I think I might have said this the first time we talked. I was a writer and then an editor for a political magazine called The Perspective. And we were both very involved in activism and then also in commentary on what was going on at the time politically. It was during the early 90s. There was a lot going on that sort of preceded the affirmative action politics that came in the mid 90s when I was at UC Berkeley, when Proposition 209 passed. I can't remember if we talked about that, but at the time in the early 90s, what I remember, there was a conversation specifically about diversity. Clarence Thomas was going through his Supreme Court confirmation also during those years. And I remember writing an article when I was in college about him and his background and his civil rights record. And then also, I don't know if you have read or read about Professor Derrick Bell, who was one of the founders of critical race theory. He was a professor at the law school at the time at Harvard, and he was very involved in bringing attention to the issue of faculty diversity hiring. So there were a lot of sort of rallies that he spoke at. He did a lot of writing on the topic of faculty diversity hiring. I believe at the time, there were no Black women on the faculty at Harvard Law School. And what I remember for sure is that he was trying to call attention to that issue of the fact that there were very few women of color and no Black women law professors. And so he actually ended up leaving Harvard in the midst of that. And you can learn more about that if you're interested. But those were some of the things that at the time, the issue of diversity itself was very much on the table. Clarence Thomas was somebody that we were watching very closely. And Derrick Bell, at the kind of moment when critical legal studies and critical race theory were being sort of generated at Harvard Law School and other law schools at the time, and he was a really active voice. So yes, very active conversation, and also the kind of beginning of the racism and police brutality kind of more modern conversation at the time, the acquittal of the police officers who were involved in the Rodney King beating were acquitted when I was in college as well, I believe in my junior year. And so there were a lot of conversations around race and power, some of them having to do with college admissions and university diversity, and then some of them also having to do with police brutality and race. So a lot of the same conversations that we're having now were definitely very, very relevant 30 plus years ago. That was a very long-winded answer, but hopefully that made sense. And please fact check me on the dates, but I believe that those are all pretty close.
No, that was great. I think we're going to circle back to talking about your time at UC Berkeley and Proposition 209 later, because that's obviously very pertinent to everything going on right now. But just to jump into the decisions, what was your first initial gut reaction when everything came out?
So I am co-writing a book on the origins and political development of race-conscious affirmative action with my good friend from UC Berkeley, who is now a sociologist at Northwestern, Anthony S. Chen, Tony Chen. And we were actually on a writing retreat 2 weeks ago when the decision came down. So we were together and we were processing. Every day we're waking up to kind of see what the decision would be. We're in California, so it's 3 hours Pacific Coast time. So the decisions were coming in at 7 o'clock in the morning. So we were very aware that the decision was going to be happening. And we were processing it in the context of the work that we're doing on the origins of race-conscious affirmative action. So it was, I'm glad that we were together because we had a lot of time to really talk about it. I don't think either one of us was surprised, given the way the oral arguments went, given the current makeup of the court, but I still was quite shocked and really saddened. I think just it kind of hit me and hit us over the course of that whole day of kind of talking about it, writing about it. We talked to a bunch of folks from the media, and just to have just such a momentous generational change happen in the way it did. I mean, really, in my lifetime, affirmative action has existed throughout my entire lifetime. And to have this moment where just this policy that's been so central, just like with abortion access and abortion rights and, you know, so many of the other civil rights that we've come to really count on in our country, this is one where it's just now basically gone, and it feels incredibly momentous, both as somebody who, for me, is writing about this issue, but also somebody who is involved in admissions, graduate admissions at NYU, and obviously as a teacher at NYU, as a professor, thinking about the impact on my classroom and on admissions to my department and my program. So pretty, not surprised, but also pretty shocked, if that makes sense.
I think that totally makes sense. And Hannah and I are so used to right after a decision comes out, we'll write about it or we'll do a podcast about it. And I think for this one, it was a little harder because we were processing the decision as students and as people that have and will be applying to college, and less so as Supreme Court reporters. It was like, this is a real decision that is going to affect us in the next year in a way that other decisions have not hit home that hard.
Yes, absolutely. And I think that just in the wake of so many other really momentous decisions. And then I was also particularly watching the decision that came down the next day in 303 Creative related to LGBTQ plus rights. And so I was like bracing myself for that decision as well. And it just felt like the hits kind of kept coming. And again, none of that was surprising given the current makeup of the court and current politics, but yeah, just really brutal all around.
And I think you're right that it wasn't surprising. I think we would have been so shocked if the decision had gone the other way, but was there something specifically in the ruling that did surprise you?
I think it's interesting. I've learned, you know, I'm not a lawyer. I listen to a lot of political or legal commentary and read a lot. I think I got this from Strict Scrutiny. So I'm probably quoting from them or citing from them here. But just the idea that this court is changing a lot of fundamental decisions, but not 100% admitting that that's what it's doing. So in this case, and I think that analysis is from Strict Scrutiny, that in this case, they didn't say we're striking down Grutter and Gratz. They didn't say we're striking down Bakke. In the Roberts decision, there was like the tiniest opening for the fact that there could potentially be a scenario under Strict Scrutiny where race could potentially be considered. And then there was this carve out for military institutions. And so there are just these sort of places where I couldn't quite tell how to frame the language exactly. And I could see that the way that this was being reported was, oh, race conscious affirmative action is overturned. But it wasn't directly in the decision that that's exactly what the court was doing, which I think is really interesting. And I guess that to me was a little surprising that it wasn't just a full out, this is an overturning of our own precedents. It was really trying to just narrow the strict scrutiny doctrine as much as possible. And again, not as a lawyer, I'm not really sure what I'm talking about, but from what I can tell, that's what that piece did, is to say, we're not saying that it's not a compelling governmental interest to have diversity in higher education. We're not saying that there couldn't be a way in which a school or a policy could meet the definition of strict scrutiny. But in these cases, and basically in most cases, because these goals are not, you know, according to the Roberts decision, not measurable and not kind of time stamped, they don't pass constitutional musters. And also, I think it was maybe a little bit surprised that they kind of mushed together the Harvard and the UNC decisions and kind of collapsed the distinction between Title VI and the Equal Protection Clause, which, again, I'm not a lawyer, but it seemed to me like they were kind of doing something there that was, again, just like maneuvering around something, but not doing something very directly. I'd be curious to know your analysis of that and whether that piece was surprising to you, that kind of not direct overturn, but basically doing the overturning.
Yeah, I think it was surprising, but also very in line with what this court has done in terms of how they've dealt with Lemon in the establishment of religion cases, in terms of like, it's just not relevant anymore, but we're not overruling it. We're just going to kind of sidestep without actually going through the stare decisis analysis. So that was kind of fascinating to me. And then I think, you know, we'll talk about it later, but this idea that diversity might be commendable, but it's not actually a coherent enough reason to qualify for strict scrutiny, which it seemed like they had held so tightly to this diversity rationale. And then all of a sudden they're saying it's just not actually really a thing. So that was weird to me.
I think there's something to be said there for something. I think the strict scrutiny amazing host said like years ago about how they're really operating the court these days, and honestly for a hot minute, this was like a long time ago, but in a way where they're kind of taking a chair and like knocking the legs off of it, and they're not really saying they're doing it, but they're not going to tip the chair over. Like, they're not going to be like just outright like, oh, we're overturning this, but they're going to like knock the legs off the chair such that it falls over and be like, oh, whoopsies. So I think there's something to be said for that. And it feels very on brand, I guess is the best way to say it. It just feels so on brand for the Roberts Court. And it's honestly a little bit frustrating because it can be very hard to interpret.
Yeah.
To jump to kind of what the justices were thinking about and how we should think about the framing that they used. In our previous interview, we had talked with you about the myth of merit, that America can be a perfect equal meritocracy. Do you think that the justices fell victim to this myth in their opinion?
I do think so. I think kind of more than anything, and I'm still trying to work this out and reading through especially the kind of back and forth between Justice Thomas and Justice Jackson, but also I think in the Roberts decision and then in the Sotomayor dissent, that I think there's connected to the idea of merit, but also kind of more broadly, I think there's a real difference in the way that the justices continue to view the role of racism and white supremacy in the US. And I think that is related to merit, because if you believe that racism is still a present force and not just a past force, you understand that merit is not race neutral and that there is white supremacy baked into the idea of meritocracy and the use of grades and test scores alone to judge applicants. But I think that's where I was really seeing the kind of difference there in the way that they used the Brown decision, and then the way that I think there's an assumption in the Roberts decision, and then it seems like definitely in the Thomas concurrence, just that paying attention to racism and even just taking Justice O'Connor's 25-year doctrine and Grutter, that's not something that is needed by the courts anymore. And that to me just seems like a big break in the courts and a big break in the way we see race in this country. And I think that the role of Asian Americans in the suit and then in the discourse even adds to that too, like the fact that Bloom did not have a specific Asian American plaintiff in this case, but rather than making the Harvard case a case about white students really work to divide folks of color by making the discourse about Asian American applicants and purported discrimination. So I think it's sort of part of this broader conversation about the continued role of racism in US society. And then that connects to merit and meritocracy.
Yeah, I think that's spot on. I remember listening to something, and this is totally unrelated, but an interviewer just straight up asked Mike Pence, who's running for president, obviously, like, is there systemic racism still in America? And he just hedged and hedged and hedged and wouldn't really say anything. And it's just like, there's this basic divide on whether people can admit that we still need to be thinking about racism when we're making decisions about higher education and the workplace and et cetera, which is kind of shocking to me because I'm in a bubble where it seems like everyone acknowledges that we should still be grappling with racism. I think it was similarly like what the court said, Grutter enshrined these logical endpoints and these sunset provisions for race-based affirmative action. So they were just following what Grutter had said in overruling affirmative action. How is that legitimate? Just to say that, okay, because we said 20 years ago that everything was probably going to be fine by now, that it's okay.
Yeah, I think that O'Connor, it was just kind of an accident that she was, you know, it was a rhetorical thing she was doing with the Bakke decision, which was 25 years before the Grutter decision. So I think she picked the number 25 because it was 25 years from Bakke. It hasn't been 25 years yet. So if they were really going with that, then they would have given us another 5 years. But right, yes. So I think, yeah, it isn't a constitutional anything. It's just kind of following some rhetoric from a decision from 20 years ago. Yeah.
I find it like profoundly frustrating, that entire thing. I just don't understand. I mean, I understand, but I find it hard to grapple with. I mean, honestly, how divorced is the court's opinion from the reality on the ground? A lot of public schools are still incredibly segregated, and there's not necessarily equal opportunity for every student or every applicant, especially to elite university.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. This also gets into what the role of higher education is. And if you go back to the work that my co-author and I are doing is about the origins of race-conscious affirmative action and the people who are really interested in taking race into account in an affirmative way at the very beginning in the early to mid 60s, they thought of higher education and of their institutions as being an active part, or they wanted to make them more of an active part of racial progress at a time when, in the civil rights movement, that was a big conversation about how racial progress should happen. And so the early adopters of affirmative action were very interested in using higher education as a way to make racial progress and to help with accelerating equal educational opportunity. And I think that for higher ed, and this was a conversation, we can talk about this if you want, in the 90s when Prop 209 passed in California, eliminating race-conscious and gender-conscious affirmative action, that the conversation then was, okay, well, we don't have this tool in higher education, so we should focus more on K-12 and on the pipeline. But that's really incredibly hard to do. There's not a lot of public will for that, for improving opportunity and for reducing all of the systemic racial inequality in K-12 education. And with this decision, I think it takes a tool away from higher education to be part of that kind of broader arc of education for individual applicants. You know, I think race-conscious affirmative action acknowledges that there are inequalities built into K-12 education and to the measures that we use for college admissions, like AP course taking or standardized testing or these things that are part of what people who only want to look very narrowly at a definition of merit would say these are what we should look at. Having affirmative action as a tool allows us to say, okay, we understand that there are inequalities that are kind of built into people being ready and able to show up at the door of an admissions office, figuratively speaking. So yeah, I do think it kind of takes away a tool for higher education there. And it's not really going to be higher ed's role to solve the inequities of K-12 education. Unfortunately, it's not something that higher ed has ever really been able to do, in part because there just isn't that much of a political will in K-12 education for solving those inequities. in a structural way.
Right. And I think it kind of gets back to what this court does in terms of not being experts on education policy and legislating from the bench in terms of like, well, why don't you just solve K through 12 education then if you're so worried about it? Like, why don't you just fund it more? That's not possible, right? Like, this is the best solution they had come up with for just trying to ameliorate the inequities in higher education. And then the court's just like, well, figure something else out. Surely you can do it, but there's just not the will there.
Yeah. And I think on top of that, too, it seems like the courts are really removing some deference that they held onto for higher education. In the Roberts decision, you see that he's really saying, like, how can we trust you in higher education to make your own decisions and to kind of keep hold of the Constitution in making those decisions? And there had been a history of the courts giving more deference to higher ed institutions. And with the Harvard case, it's the first private school case here. And we really see that the court is really inserting itself into private higher education in this way.
And this is going to take us away from the analysis of the case. But I feel like I need to ask, because it feels like there's basic confusion about the actual facts of the Harvard and UNC case in terms of how did the schools actually use race when they're making their decisions? And probably the justices don't even agree on that. Could you tell us a little bit about how you see what Harvard did, and especially Harvard, but also UNC?
Yeah, I don't know enough about it. And in part, I'm saying it that way because I felt like the way that Roberts characterized it seemed inaccurate to me. And I would have to go back to, I think where I would go is the Burroughs decision in the district court case. I feel like there's a lot of just meaty details in that decision where she really looks at all of the evidence that was presented to her. But I don't feel like I can speak to it enough. I just know that when I was reading the way that Roberts characterized it, it seemed really like he had a spin on it that didn't seem like it came from the facts of the case, but I can't speak to it. Did you have thoughts?
I think just this idea that race could actually be the deciding factor in any single case. I wasn't sure if that was true. That's the way Roberts made it seem, was that like, just as much as your extracurriculars could determine whether you're admitted, so too could race. And I kind of didn't see it that way. I kind of saw it as like one of 20 or so factors that they take into consideration, a plus rather than a check or an X. So that was a little confusing. I don't think anyone really understands how schools decide who to admit. And it just seemed weird to have Roberts kind of asserting in such a strong way that race was this outsized factor.
Yeah, I agree.
I don't know.
I think it's fascinating because especially a school like Harvard really purports to have holistic admissions practices. And the whole point of that is that race is just a piece of the puzzle, and each extracurricular activity you do is a piece of the puzzle, and they're trying to piece together you as a person and understand what complex, nuanced ideas you're going to bring to a class. And I also think, honestly, going through the college admissions process, maybe this isn't fair to say, but it feels a lot of times like it's kind of just random luck, right? It's like who your admissions officer is, if your personal statement resonates with them, if they can see you being beneficial to their class. And so because of that, I think it's hard to be like, okay, all admissions officers everywhere are doing this and that, because it's really like there are two admissions officers maybe who will really read your case, your file, and they read thousands, and then they go to a meeting and they have to defend you. And it's interesting to me because I don't know if there's just not an understanding of that because college admissions have changed so much and are just so nebulous, but it seems a little weird to me. And I mean, we've talked about this a little bit, but in his opinion, Roberts claimed that universities' interest in a diverse class, like training future leaders and acquiring new knowledge based on diverse outlooks, which is really important, and promoting a really robust marketplace of ideas and all these things are really commendable, but they're not sufficiently coherent to allow for review under strict scrutiny. And like, what does this mean? Is that really a sound proposition?
Yeah, I agree with you that it's, again, I think the court really inserting itself into the process in a way that it's not really carved out to do. It sort of is acting as sort of level above an admissions office or as some kind of higher ed administrator. And that's not its role. Just like in a lot of the desegregation cases after the Brown decision, there was a lot of conversation about what role the court should play constitutionally in making decisions about school assignment and what happens inside schools too. So I think in this, just thinking back to the oral arguments, this was kind of picking up on, I think from what I can remember, definitely Thomas had a lot of engagement with the idea of, okay, what is diversity and how do we measure it? And then I would even say Kavanaugh and Barrett too, where it just seems like they were kind of swirling around trying to come up with a reasoning here to make this kind of argument and a decision that for them, the idea of diversity or the idea of having diversity be enough of a compelling interest that it could leave some kind of affirmative attention to race in place. It seems like they were sort of trying to come up with some way to put it in this way that for them they couldn't. And to me, it goes back to the point about deference in higher education, that it's not really letting us in higher ed do our job in this way. And if they really were serious about, you know, this kind of test for strict scrutiny of having diversity be measurable, what is their role going to be in that? What would colleges and universities need to devise? And then who is overseeing that in this kind of next phase of admissions where they seem to have put sort of an unmeetable test in place, but where they've also kind of given themselves a lot of power over higher education?
I know, it's almost like, is every school just going to have to run their affirmative action policy by the court all of a sudden and see, like, is this okay or is this too much? And it's just like, that's not a way to run higher education, it seems like. Okay, this has been interesting to me. I feel like in the aftermath of the ruling, a lot of people are talking about how we think of affirmative action and it seems really great in principle, but people don't actually like it in practice in terms of the idea that someone is being admitted above someone else for their race. Is that because people just don't understand exactly what affirmative action is? Or if we're so interested in diversity, why don't we like the means of achieving that diversity?
Yeah, this goes back to something that we studied in the 90s also after Prop 209. The way you word the polling question for this completely matters. So whether somebody says they're for it or against it is very connected to the way a question is worded. So that's why I think the public opinion data is so confusing, because the questions get asked in so many different ways. And some of those ways kind of skew people towards seeming to support or seeming to oppose affirmative action. And then I think the kind of broader issue is the way we think about what higher education is, whether it's kind of an individual good or a social good. And I think about this also in the context of the ruling that came the following day on Biden's loan plan, that we don't really have in this country a way of thinking about higher education as a public good that serves the whole. There are many other countries where higher education is paid for or highly subsidized, and we just don't have that in the US. And I don't think we ever will, because we see getting a college degree as an individual thing rather than a social thing, you know, rather than as something that could really serve society. And I connect that here because I think that if we could see college admissions less as just, did I get this thing individually versus did the collective benefit from the way this decision came down? Or even, did I get this thing? And then what is my experience going to be of this thing? I think we could think about this more collectively. Like, no college since ever has admitted a class fully on tests and grades, right? So when the SATs started to become a thing in the early 20th century, because of all kinds of xenophobia and anti-Semitism and classism, colleges very quickly went to, wait, there are all these people getting really high scores on these tests, and these are people we don't want in our schools. So we need to come up with other ways of measuring what merit is. So even a century ago, we were not looking at college admissions as just being connected to grades and test scores. And I don't think anybody would really say they want to be in a college class with only people who have the highest GPAs and the highest test scores. I don't think anybody who goes to a selective college would say they want to be sitting in a classroom with only people with perfect ACT or SAT scores, only people with perfect GPAs. And so therefore, I do think that people understand on some level that they get a benefit out of an admissions process that takes other things into consideration, But then when it comes down to, like, I just think the asking of the question sometimes solidifies and kind of confuses the response and the narrative.
I think that's honestly just fascinating. I mean, yeah, I would never, ever want to be in a class with people who just have the highest, like, thinking about going to college next year and thinking about, like, the seminars I'm going to be taking. The idea of that just being literally, like, oh, here's everyone from all these different schools with their 4.0s and their 1600s. Just sounds boring, honestly. It would provide any sort of substantive discussion, and no hate to anyone. Like, I graduated with a 4.0. I'm not bashing people for getting good grades or getting perfect SAT scores. But if that's the only factor that you're going to take into consideration, that sounds like it would not build a very interesting class experience at all.
I think just this idea that, well, at least how I think about it, in terms of affirmative action really is only an issue for really, really selective schools. And I think we often kind of over magnify or emphasize the impact of affirmative action just across the nation. So do people actually understand what affirmative action is and what it does, or are we just over emphasizing it?
Yeah, I mean, I think it goes back to what we were talking about before, about the kind of conversation about merit or the conversation about fairness and how people think about that in the US, that it comes down to kind of an individual understanding. And people really like to think that things are fair in the US. And it has not changed at all since I started thinking about this almost 30 years ago, this conversation around what merit means and this kind of just knee-jerk response to, oh, well, it's not fair if you take race into consideration. And I think that's especially interesting given that we have had such a shift in thinking or a shift in practice about standardized tests since the pandemic. So the fact that schools have gone test optional over the past couple of years, which has just driven up the, I'm sure you're thinking about this now, right? Like, you look at the test scores online and you can't even, you have to scroll a lot to see, were these pre-2020 or 2021 or were they post? And you see that the numbers have gone up so much since test optional, because people are only really reporting their scores if they think it'll help them. And I think this has prompted a conversation about standardized testing, but that hasn't migrated over to the conversation about constitutes fair admissions here in some cases. Like, if we know that the tests are problematic and we know that they don't need to be considered for a fair amount of the class, like if you look at the numbers of like what percentage of the class at any really selective schools got in not having submitted test scores, it's pretty large right now. But that still doesn't seem to have changed the conversation around what merit means in a way that I think it would be really interesting to have that conversation. I do think that we'll get there once we have more data about how test optional has impacted admissions. We're still so new with like the number of classes that we can only look at data for the past few years. But I think there is a role for that kind of broader conversation that we'll see over the next couple of years. And I hope that that will include other things like legacy admissions and these other forms of kind of group consideration that are now kind of being part of the conversation about affirmative action as well.
Right. I think it's just interesting and always important to remember that we are just very much in this time of radical change in how admissions works in terms of going test optional and all the considerations around legacy. And then with this ruling, there's a lot in flux and it's going to be hard to tell how much things have changed until a few years out. So in the meantime, and this is, I hate getting emails from colleges because it's just always spam in my inbox, but I've gotten a lot that say we're just as committed to diversity as we once were and you're still going to have a diverse experience. And I'm sure Hannah's gotten emails from Yale that say, like, don't worry, we care about diversity just as much as we did before. But the court said you can't indirectly achieve this regime that we hold unlawful today through application, essays, or other means. Where are schools going to go next if they're still holding on to this value of diversity?
It's such a huge question. We've been having the conversation at my school, which is the School of Education, Culture, and Human Development at NYU Steinhardt. This whole year, we've been sort of starting to, I personally have no power in this at all, but I've been part of the conversation of, okay, this decision is coming. We need to start looking at this. And I know that every selective college and university has had that conversation this year of, okay, what is this really going to look like when this decision is handed down? And then we have to pivot really quickly to what our application looks like for the next admission cycle. And I honestly don't know that we're there yet in terms of like what it's actually going to look like. I think there are some things that could be very politically unpopular that schools could do, like get rid of legacy admissions, which some really selective schools have already done. That would be one thing. I don't think that's going to happen very widely, but I think that's one thing. They could get rid of donor admissions. They could get rid of these forms of privilege that are clearly tipping the scales towards white applicants. I think it's important to note that there is, you know, according to the social science and according to what we know from the states that did not have affirmative action as of this summer because of past state laws, that there's no alternative to race-conscious admissions for producing racially diverse classes. And class socioeconomic status is not a direct alternative to taking race affirmatively into consideration. So that is one that has obviously been floated by people, and it's just not going to do what race-conscious affirmative action did for racial diversity in higher ed. So I think there's going to be a lot of scrambling. I know that I've had colleagues and friends at a lot of different institutions, and we're all just waiting for some direction from our institutions as to what the next step would be. And I think a lot of that is the law is just very unclear. I will say that I'm worried that colleges and universities are going to overcorrect in the sense of they're going to be so worried about lawsuits that I think they're going to go too far in the other direction of removing things that were not part of this decision. This decision was about admissions. It was not about programming or spaces on campus that are for students of color, or there are lots of other things that take race into consideration in an affirmative way that were not touched by this decision. It doesn't mean there won't be lawsuits down the line, but I am worried that, and I remember this from after Prop 209 in California, that I just think schools are going to be so worried about being sued that they're likely to go too far in the other direction. So that's what I'm watching for. I don't know. I personally haven't gotten direction from NYU about what our next step will be for. And I don't do undergrad admissions, but I do graduate admissions. And I, you know, this is going to be an ongoing conversation for sure over the next few months.
I mean, honestly, cover your ears, Elise. But early decisions come out in like 5 months. That's not a lot of time to completely change the way we view holistic admissions processes. That's just not a lot of time. And I know it's because it was a controversial decision, so it came out at the end of the term. But it just, like, I feel a little bad for all these admissions officers who are probably scrambling so hard this summer, just trying to figure out what their procedures are going to be. And I agree with you that there's a really big risk of schools going too far in the other direction to avoid being sued. And I want to talk to you about Prop 209, but a lot of people have talked about the UCs as a new model for keeping schools diverse. But I don't know that the UCs are a great model for keeping schools diverse. My boyfriend goes to UC Berkeley, and he's one of the 3% of Black students on campus. Like, it's not a super duper diverse space. I've been, like, it's just not. And so I'm curious what your thoughts are around Prop 209 and using the UCs as a model for how to achieve diversity without affirmative action.
So after Prop 209 in the mid-90s, there was the UCs are of varying degrees of selectivity, but at the most selective UCs, UCLA and UC Berkeley, well, across the board, and then at those two specifically, the number specifically of Black and Latinx students dropped a lot and took just either, I would have to look at the most recent data, but did not recover for a long time, if at all. I still don't think that at UC Berkeley, the percent Black and Latinx matches the percent in the state. I could be wrong, but I'm fairly sure that that's true. and definitely, I think, did not come back up from the big precipitous drop in the mid-90s. Because that also was a state level decision, and people who were applying to those schools could have applied to other schools where they felt they might be more welcome and had more of a sense of belonging, they could do that. So I think that some of the numbers there reflected people leaving the state when they could for school. So now we have a decision that covers the entire country. So that's a little bit different. So I think in the 90s, with the states that were eliminating affirmative action in higher education, there was a sense that those states were increasingly inhospitable to specifically Black, Latinx, and Indigenous Native American students, and some Asian American groups. Of course, that's a hugely diverse group. So that, I think, is a little bit different in the sense that those were mostly legislative decisions, and this being a judicial decision, it'll be interesting to see. But I think a lesson from California is that in that time, there was a lot of conversation about potential class-based alternatives. Those did not work in the same way, and they won't work in the same way now. So I think what people have said is, oh, what happened in California is eventually they put a lot of resources and a lot of time and energy into coming up with a quote unquote race neutral alternative. I don't think that even with all of that attention, the numbers reflect a pre-Prop 209 level of racial diversity. I would have to fact check that to be completely sure, but I don't think we should fool ourselves into thinking that California does present a model for anything other than really bad news for what happens when affirmative action goes away in that way.
And California is definitely an outlier for how much energy the state is actually willing to put into recruiting and creating a pipeline. I don't think we can take that as a guarantee to happen at other schools across the country.
Right. And I just think there's a difference too between public and private education. You know, you can't do what a lot of the public school systems have done when they haven't had affirmative action to use, like with Texas or California or Florida with the percent plans. You can't do a percent plan in private education. So there are these tools that are possible. And then you also have all these public resources. Of course, California's higher ed is very underfunded. That does not get the resources it should get, but you can put public resources into public flagship schools in a way that you won't do at Harvard or Yale, even though they are very well resourced places that can be putting their own resources towards these efforts as well. But I just think there is a difference in public and private education there too.
I feel like we just need to talk a little bit, and I know we've been talking forever, but what do you think the loophole that Roberts kind of carved out about, you can explain your racial experiences in an individual essay, how is that going to play out? And is the court just drawing this line that isn't really decipherable in terms of you can talk about it in an essay, but not in any other context?
Yeah, I think it is drawing a line that isn't really decipherable. I think you couldn't, there's kind of no world in which they could have said you can't write about race in your essay. Like, they would have run into some serious other problems if they were going to say that. I am concerned about this carve out and what it will mean for what schools might do, and that it's just framing race primarily through trauma and sort of framing the possibility of that essay as mostly through trauma. I know the wording was a little bit broader than that in the Roberts decision, but I'm worried that that's sort of what he had in mind there, that writing about overcoming something might be something that you could do. I think the carve out, I don't see that he couldn't have articulated a carve out in that way, but I am worried about what the implications of it are going to be for what students of color are going to be expected to do or write about in their essays.
I agree with you completely. I think that's definitely the framing there. And I mean, I think that's always in a way been the framing of the college essay, to be 100% honest.
Yeah,
I think like, sure. Yeah. The good college essays are mostly about bad things and overcoming them. And maybe it's just because there's a natural story arc there. I don't know. But yeah, it's definitely concerning. And my last question, I want to ask a question for Elise and maybe for your kid too, and for all the other lovely upcoming high school seniors I know. But if you were an incoming high school senior planning to apply to college this fall, what would you want to know about the court's ruling and how it could affect you? How are you framing this to your son even? I mean, what do you think that an incoming senior needs to know?
I think that might have been what a lot of the schools were doing the day of the decision and putting out those statements that you got and I got and we all got in our inboxes and kind of signaling to potential applicants that their values have not changed. But what I really want to know is how practice is going to change. And I also really want to know, this is maybe less, well, no, I think this is for a college applicant too. I'm really worried about data collection and the tool that we have now to collect data and how racially diverse our schools are. I'm worried that some of that is going to go away. And so I would want my kid or any other kid looking at colleges to have accurate data about what their campuses are going to look like when it comes to race. And I'm worried that this decision is going to take away some of our ability on campus to really have accurate data or to know accurate data. I'm not sure what the Common App is going to do. I was looking at this week that I saw that in the last year, the Common App, they're still going to ask the question about race and ethnicity, which of course is always optional to answer, but that colleges and universities are going to have the option to hide the answers to those questions. And so I'm just interested to know what the interface is going to be now between the Common App and I guess in California, the UC application, which I'm not sure how they ask about race now, but just what the interface will be between the application and the schools or the applicant and the schools.
Yeah, I think it's just we don't really know much. And that's scary, certainly, as a high school senior. But we'll always come back to you to ask all of our questions too and just to figure it out with. You're such a helpful resource and we're so grateful that you came on for the second time to talk to us.
Thank you. Yeah, good luck with your applications and good luck making sense of this court in the kind of roundup session.
Gosh, to be honest, that conversation was honestly more therapeutic than anything. I think Hannah and I both needed a chance to ask a lot of the questions that are still on our minds after that decision. It's one thing to read the abundance of opinions and concurrences and dissents that the court wrote, and it's another thing to actually try to digest what the decision means for applying students and for students like Hannah who are attending college next year. And we're just so lucky that we had someone as knowledgeable as Lisa to ask those questions with us and to try to answer them as best we could.
We're going to keep doing episodes on this decision and hopefully others do some term recapping. And maybe Elise will agree to do a Supreme Court gossip session on record one time with me. But for now, leave us a rating, drop us a review, and for more coverage of the Supreme Court by teenagers, you can check out the High School SCOTUS website at highschoolscotus.com. On the blog, you can read oral argument previews, opinion analysis, and interviews with eminent legal scholars. Literally everything you need to stay in touch with the court. That's highschoolscotus.com.